Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tap Into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and our guest today is John Chavez, who is the founder of DMT Quest, which is a nonprofit organization who is committed to the research and understanding of endogenous dimethyltryptamine. How you doing, John?
Doing great, Adam. I'm just happy to be here with you. We've had some conversations in the past, and I felt like this was meant to be, obviously, based on our own experiences.
Well, and may I say, super interesting conversation. So, you know, you contacted me after hearing some of my stories about my near-death experience, and I talk about endogenous DMT, and I didn't realize the scope of research that had been done on this and actually proving levels of endogenous DMT and in what circumstance they are elevated in your body. So I'm going to leave the link to your documentary because I suggest anyone who's listening to this really should watch this afterwards. But let's just kind of get into an idea. Like, how did you get into, you know, starting a nonprofit organization for the research and education of endogenous DMT?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I had a strange experience in 2013. Damn, over 10 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it really changed my perspective of what was possible within the human physiology and even outside. I was having some health problems leading up to this mystical experience that changed my perspective. I had a blood clot in my lung in 2012, bad digestive issues, bad sleepish, inability to sleep. So I was having like systemic failure to a certain extent. And I got desperate for to heal myself somehow. The doctors couldn't figure it out. They didn't really have any answers for me. So I went the Google doctor route and accidentally ended up healing myself in a rather dramatic way. Induced a very extensive gastrointestinal purge or cleanse. Massive shitting on the toilet in layman's terms. And what happened is it induced this thing called, I guess, a Kundalini awakening. I wasn't really aware that that thing even existed. I had no interest in spirituality, mysticism, or even psychedelics at that point in my life. But what happened is that after the purge, there was like an electric surge from my tailbone up to my head and out my hands. And it was a very profound feeling that I had, not just of electricity, but of connectivity with a force greater than myself. Just mind you, I'd never really been interested in concepts like God or the greater force or anything like that. And it was almost in an instant, which was like, wow, this is really a strange sensation that I'm having. And I can't explain it. So anyhow, as the day progressed after I induced that healing in myself, I realized that for whatever reason, my mental imagery or intent was starting to have an effect on my environment. So when I would grab like my car keys or something, they would like get hot really quick. If I was like walking under like a telephone wire, I could feel like a buzz. Like it was almost like it felt like it was like a couple inches away from my head, even though it was like 30 feet away. I was like, wow, that's weird. I didn't even know that that was possible, that you can feel like the sensation of electromagnetism at a distance. Felt like my body had become more sensitive to a very high degree. A couple of days later after the purge, let's go back. So the day of the purge, the day of the experience, my girlfriend at the time, she came home and she'd been diagnosed with lupus years earlier and been dealing with some health issues on her own. And I just remember a distinct feeling of when I touched her, it was like a surge from my body. I could only describe it as electricity going from my body into hers. And she described the sensation the same exact time that I described mine. Although in hers, she felt like a surge in her body and a sensation of pain dissipating rather instantly. And I was like, wow, that's really strange because I didn't know that that was possible and still trying to figure it out to this day. But, in the days after that, there was more strange experiences that would arise. Like, I don't know if any of your listeners, can relate, but, you know, at night when you're, if you like get cold feet at night or something, might be a circulation issue or whatnot. But, I, for whatever reason, I had the intuition to, project this electric surge that I was feeling in my body into, my feet. First, I started with my right foot, and I had the intent. I was like, let's just see if I can get it warm. You know, mind you, I'd never been interested in biofeedback or any of that things that later on I would read about, that this stuff had been studied for a long time during altered states. But anyhow, I envisioned my right foot getting warm. Within like a second, it felt like it was warm. And I grabbed it with my hands to verify the sensation that I was feeling inside my body. And it was warm while my left foot was still cold. I was like, wow, that's interesting. Seems like somehow I can kind of verify that I'm having this specific intent in my body. And I do the same thing with my left foot. Instantly gets warm based on the visualization. I touch it to verify. And at that point, I'm like, okay. I didn't even know that autonomic nervous system control was a thing at the time. I'd not had any exposure to that concept. A day or two later, I was at my at a dinner table with my girlfriend, and we kind of just had like the low lights and just listening to some music, trying to process this whole thing. She came from like a lineage of mystics, so she was like, you know, what took you so long? And this is all new to me, so yeah. I'm like, yeah, I'm still trying to process. Still trying to process to this day a bit, but anyhow, so we're sitting at the dinner table, and I had the intuition that you know, maybe that same exact visualization that took place within my body that could have like such a targeted effect, maybe that can actually go like through the air or whatnot. So I did the same exact visualization of sort of electricity going through my body, but instead it was out of my body and into her head. And it was a strange intuition to try. And when I did, and the visualization got very precise, which took about maybe 5 seconds, her head jolted back and she was just like, whoa, what was that? And because I didn't tell her, and then I told her, like, you know, I was just trying to do a visualization. It seems as though it's not relegated to the nervous system. It feels like it can go outside the body, and it did, because it induced a sensation in her. So obviously the next logical leap would be, well, maybe the whole concept of telepathy, another subject I'd never had any interest in, maybe that's how it could work. I'm not saying that that's how it would work, but do the same thing, visualization over the visualization, just coming up with random images, and, you know, lo and behold, she would get it. We did about 3 or 4 times in a row. And at that point, it was clear to me that the concept of telepathy was a real thing, because it wasn't like I was asking her to, you know, guess a number, either 1 or 2 or black or white or red.
Yeah, 50% odd of success. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't really like those type of telepathy experiments. They don't really tell you a lot, but this one was like completely random. So I was like, okay, the likelihood of that happening is pretty much zero. So the fact that there was success in that proved to, at least to myself, that it was real. And then subsequently in months after, you know, I actually ended up teaching people and showing other people how to do it. And that took it to another level of verification. But yeah, so that kind of put me on the path of really trying to understand, you know, what happened and what was going on, and whether there was a, like a biological explanation as to what I was experiencing. And, you know, I try to have different conversations with different people. I'd worked in the biotech industry for about a decade prior to this. I'd gotten out of the industry and was in a completely different field, but I still kept in touch with some of the coworkers, from that time. And they were scientists, and they were very not open to, what I was referring to, which was very frustrating initially, because I was like, you guys are scientists. Are you guys supposed to be curious about things like this and trying to uncover the nature of reality, when it was actually the opposite? So, you know, led me down the path of trying to understand like how to communicate with that type of mental framework. And it was interesting, at my sister's wedding, it was like a year, or within like 9 months or something of this awakening experience. I approached my cousin at the time, who was in medical school, and you know, I thought that he might be interested in this stuff because he had mentioned interest in like psychedelics, and he kind of just brushed me off. He's like, that didn't happen, but just look up DMT. And I didn't even heard about DMT until 2000. I guess it would probably be 2014 at this time. So I look it up and I was like, wait, there's a book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And, you know, the author is a medical doctor, Rick Strassman, who is a his hypothesis is that we produce this and it coincides with like mystical experiences. So obviously read the book, went down the rabbit hole online, And I got enamored with the notion that potentially DMT was, or upregulation of endogenous DMT coincided with these sort of abilities. And now I realized that there was something to that when I started to speak in those terms to my ex-coworkers who were scientists. And then they started to become open to having this like legitimate discussions about these sorts of things. And then basically just led me down the path of creating an anonymous blog to try to sort out whether it was even possible to, you know, put some science to what was out there with these sort of mystical experiences and tying it with endogenous DMT. So for a while, I had an anonymous blog. I just put the initials JC, and I would write about, you know, just the various sort of research out there regarding different changes in the brain waves, circadian rhythm, meditation, hypnosis, and just tying it in with the potentiality, because there was nothing verifiable that DMT was even coinciding with these sort of the changes in the brain. But little by little, created more blog posts, and after a while, it seemed as though the psychedelic community got a hold of it, and it kind of took off a bit. Dennis McKenna started to read it, and he reached out, and then I got invited to some private symposiums in the United Kingdom that are really focused on DMT entities, endogenous DMT, altered states of consciousness, and they had the who's who of scientists in that space, that like Roland Griffiths, Ralph Metzner, pretty much all the top names.
Yeah, like all the OGs. Yeah,
right. All the OGs, yeah. Dennis was there, Rupert Sheldrake, Graham Hancock, like you name it. Not all at once, supposedly, but over the several years, I've come to know all of them. And, became friends with Dennis, and he was saying, I've never seen a perspective like this. And I was like, well, like probably nobody's really had the same exact experience with the same exact background to try to put this stuff together. And I ended up compiling the blog into a book. So the books are called Questions for the Lion Tamer, 1 and 2. They're both about endogenous DMT and altered states of consciousness. And then I realized, you know, the next step, if you really want to create a social impact and awareness that these mystical sort of experiences seem to be a real thing, you probably have to go into film or a better way to get the word out. So yeah, that's kind of what I ended up doing. I was like, okay, well, first and foremost, you know, I reached out to all the scientists that were supposedly in the space of DMT research. Nobody was doing endogenous DMT research because there was no funding. And that's what led me to form the DMT Quest nonprofit to try to drive this awareness that, you know, this field needs funding, and obviously doing the film to create that awareness. And that's basically where we're at in a nutshell. Yeah, I mean, to summarize it all.
Well, and yeah, man, that's actually a really cool story. And just to put context into this too, like what you're describing in your story is something that has been described in Eastern philosophy for quite some time. And the idea of being able to have these states of awareness and people using breath work and a variety of other different mechanisms to do this has been going on for thousands of years. Like you tapped into something that's been, you know, a time-honored tradition in just different parts of this planet. And just for context too, you know, like endogenous is something that's produced inside your brain and exogenous is something that you're taking externally. So ayahuasca contains DMT and a MAO inhibitor. That would be exogenous, whereas we're referring to in this context something that's produced in your own brain. And so that's what I think is clearly defined and important in this, and much what I've referred to with my near-death experiences, which I thought was a lot more anecdotal until I watched your documentary. I didn't realize the extent of research because it almost blows my mind that there's not more awareness to it. So, you know, let's kind of get into sort of that Michigan University. You know, they did a series of research within that lab that pertains to endogenous DMT. And, you know, Rick Straussman pertained the idea that, you know, DMT was produced endogenously in your pineal gland. You know, it's been found in urine and blood for, you know, 30, 40 years. We've all known this. But nothing really ticked this over the line to have someone actually do a real study on it. So why don't you just talk about Michigan U and what they were doing and why that's incredibly relevant to what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. So in 2013, Jima Boy Jigin, a great female scientist out of University of Michigan, published a study showcasing that alongside Stephen Barker, a friend of mine and a mentor in the DMT space, they published a study showcasing that DMT seem to be produced at the pineal gland region, as well as the enzymes necessary to produce it. So that was like a definitive study that showcased that it seemed as though the mammalian system, because these studies took place in live rats. So they utilized a microdialysis probe, where basically they're taking, they're sampling brain fluid or extracellular fluid around the regions they're looking for, and then they're putting it through a process to measure the levels. So they saw that in 2013, and then there was no follow-up research until 2019 when Dr. John Dean, he was at University of Michigan at the time, now he's at UC San Diego, he published a very pivotal study, a groundbreaking study showing that it seems as though DMT is produced throughout the brain. So they found the enzymes necessary to produce DMT produced at the cortex, hippocampus, choroid plexus, as well as the pineal gland. And then he also saw probably the most important part of the study was showing that when he would take samples of the fluid of the brain, they were at similar levels to serotonin and dopamine. Obviously, serotonin and dopamine being one of the most commonly studied neurotransmitters across the world for neuroscientists. And if DMT is produced at very, very similar levels to those commonly studied neurotransmitters, probably playing a key role in our everyday waking perception and even maybe basic physiology. So that changed the game altogether regarding the discussion of endogenous DMT, because for the longest time, it was perceived that DMT was only being released during maybe traumatic instances like near-death experiences, or maybe during altered states of consciousness, or maybe during dreaming. But this study showed that there's a likelihood that DMT is modulating our everyday waking reality. So alluding to, you know, the concept that reality is a hallucination within itself, being that we are producing, you know, a powerful hallucinogen all the time, right? So it changed that whole discussion. And then the third part to the 2019 study was that he saw a 600% increase in the visual cortex of rats following cardiac arrest. So this is alluding to the notion that there is something to the whole concept of DMT being related to the near-death experience. They'd have to redo that study, just to be upfront with your viewers and listeners, is that there was a 2015 study out of Michigan that measured a bunch of neurotransmitters upregulation following cardiac arrest. And they saw a huge surge in like serotonin, in GABA, and in dozens, not in everything, but in a bunch of neurotransmitters. And they did it on, I think it was either a minute by minute or 2 minute increments, where they could see like the increase, a huge rise, like a 30-fold rise, like a minute or two after cardiac arrest, and then it would fall off. In the Dean study, he said he wanted to, but they didn't have the budget to carry it out or whatnot. They measured the DMT levels at, I think it was like 15-minute increments after death. So hypothesis is that you would see a much greater surge than 600%. If you did it on the same exact study as 2015, minute-by-minute study, if you replicate that for cardiac arrest and you look at DMT, you'd probably see, you know, a couple thousand percent spike.
And see, and so there's a lot to unpack from this. So let's just go back to finding that dimethyltryptamine is present in your brain at any given point in time on par with serotonin and dopamine. Like, two of some of the most important neurotransmitters we have, regulating mood, healing tissue, bone, you know, our pleasure centers, to some degree movement. Like, these things are necessary for us to function as, you know, as mammals. And in our evolutionary processes, if something's not useful or relevant, it doesn't last. You know what I mean? Like, this has evolved in conjunction with our growth as a species. This just didn't appear out of nowhere, and it's certainly not vestigial by any means. And so when that gets broken down, and another part of that too was that they're found that they are produced highly in visual cortexes as well, I believe. And that perhaps regulating what we see and how we interact with the world around us and our perception of reality, which is a really interesting point. And I think does, you know, leave a place for some self-reflection on that statement. You know what I mean? Like, I think this is groundbreaking. Like, I had no idea, you know, like, to some extent, I knew there was an increase of DMT during cardiac arrest. But knowing that at any given point in time during my waking hours, on par with serotonin and dopamine is dimethyltryptamine is actually wildly insane. And it blows my mind that people aren't jumping to research this. Like, how many medications are based on regulating serotonin in our body for mood? You know what I mean? And like, and that stems into a lot of other questions too, right? Like, you know, I know that DMT is also a neuroprotectant, and I can see that being an evolutionary perspective, is that when cardiac arrest occurs, dimethyltryptamine is an influx in your body, which perhaps protects your cells from hypoxia in that state. But still, even that, having these profound psychedelic-like experiences, near-death experiences, you know, I always have to wonder, what evolutionary point is that? You know what I mean? Like, what evolutionary driving force leaves us to have these powerful spiritual mystical experiences? You know, I think one can make the argument that technically, from the dawn of life, evolution basically only functions within being born and breeding. Anything outside of that is fairly irrelevant, because the purpose of this is to pass our genes on, to keep complexity going, and to perpetuate life. So outside of providing you a grace period in cardiac arrest, you know, I always have to wonder what evolutionary processes is in play to give this profoundly mystical spiritual experience when you're dying, which really plays no longer a role in your breeding cycles, other than perhaps, you know, a subtle sidetrack to cardiac arrest before reproduction. But
yeah, it is a great mystery to, I guess, delve into, like, why that even occurs, right? Unless you're on the esoteric side where you're like, oh, it makes perfect sense, right? It's like the chemical gateway to exiting the body or whatnot, right? But I guess another thing I want to bring up is that in Rick Strassman's study, so he did research on exogenous DMT. So in terms of injecting DMT into humans in the early 1990s, in the mid 1990s, and
like 5 dozen people, no? Like, it, excuse me? 5 dozen people. Like, it was a pretty big study group too. It wasn't just a handful of folks. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was a good amount of people, and he did 4 different doses. So he had like the breakthrough dose, like the slightly under breakthrough dose, and then he had a sub-psychedelic dose. So I think it was 0.05 milligrams per kilogram. And what's interesting is that nobody's had visionary experiences at the 0.05 milligrams per kilogram, the sub-psychedelic dose, but people did describe you having the sensation of euphoria. Some people would even almost describe it like heroin. So there is the concept that DMT could be like a mood modulator, not just a visionary aspect, not just a hypoxic sort of protectant. Things can have multiple roles, right? Like serotonin has multiple roles, dopamine has multiple roles. And I would presume that DMT, you know, in the vein of consistency, probably has multiple roles as well.
You know, I will say back to a comment you said before about, you know, the purpose of having these heightened levels of awareness. You know, in my experiences with psychedelics and everything, I 100% believe it is some sort of connection to infinite complexity or our spirituality. But it is funny that you, you know, much like you were talking before with all of these scientists and doctors, you have to bring it in from a certain angle to allow people to take it seriously. And then eventually when they come to their own conclusions, more often than not, they struggle with finding a relevance behind it. You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly, man. It's kind of crazy how, like, you know, there's like some scientists that are so like adverse to even discussing the DMT aspect. They want to explain it away. But there's never been a chemical in the body that's been known to have no known function. There might be chemicals that we don't know their function, but there's never been a chemical that's known to have no function. And I see some of that discourse with the scientists. I'm like, man, you guys are... Well, you guys aren't becoming scientists anymore. Like, yeah, you guys are zealots on the other side.
Well, and that's part of the problem too, right? Like, in an attempt to stay within the realm of materialism and rationalism, it's almost easier to just avoid it altogether because it brings in these questions of mysticism and perhaps spirituality. You know what I mean? Like, it makes a very structured world a little bit more shaky. You know, it's quite literally throwing rocks in a glass house when you start going down that path. If your entire foundation is literally based on rationalism, which is kind of unique. And you're seeing more and more people doing this. Like, you look at the DMTX program too, right? And even Imperial College in London, while they're working and giving people not far off what Strassman was doing, but prolonged dimethyltryptamine injections. And you're also seeing, you know, I know there's a clinical trial, I'm not sure if it's being used actively, of giving people dimethyltryptamine post-strokes. You know what I mean? As a neuroprotectant, and help rebuild certain parts of your neurological structure. So it's a very interesting concept. And now there's another thing that you have in your show as well is, you know, how to release naturally yourself without, you know, killing yourself, which is not super productive, of how do you basically cause a release of endogenous dimethyltryptamine? And again, this pertains back to ages of breathing techniques. And do you want to little talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. I mean, up until this point, it's still speculative. You know, we still have to do some definitive research, even though I want to let the cat out the bag. I've been in touch with a group out of Italy that they're actually very interested in conducting research regarding patients with, I think it's hydrocephalus, and they're taking cerebral spinal fluid from the brain directly, and they're going to have them do some Wim Hof method. So, yeah. And they want to measure DMT. So yeah, there's some scientists that are going hard in the paint these days. So, but one of the hypotheses is that when you engage in techniques that upregulate the gamma wave, that change your electrical oscillations in the brain, it coincides with a DMT release. One of the data points that support the hypothesis is that, you know, when you take DMT or 5-MeO-DMT, there is research showing that it upregulates the gamma brainwave. That's like considered a faster brainwave state than your average waking state. And when you engage in things like meditation and breath work and maybe even hypnotic states, sensory deprivation, that the gamma wave also rises. Not to say that you're going to have the same exact experience as exogenous DMT, but there is some overlap. And for some people that are neurologically gifted, they definitely have some pretty intense experiences.
Yeah, and so the Wim Hof method being one, and I've tried holotropic breathing, and since talking to you, I've been doing the Wim Hof method, and I got to admit, like, it's an interesting feeling, and basically it's, I'm going to oversimplify this, very much oversimplify, but hyperventilating, you know, taking really big breaths, exhale, very cyclical, repetitively for periods of time, breath holding, and then starting the cycle over again. It's like a series of stacks to some extent, and, you know, I did holotropic breathing, you know, probably like 8 years ago at some sort of seminar in Toronto. And man, I hyperventilate like it was my job. And my whole body was vibrating and I was having sort of closed-eyed visuals. But again, too, right? Like, you know, I'd be very curious to the amounts of DMT that are being released in your body comparative to a actual threshold dose of exogenous DMT. You know, at the end of the day, everything is dose-dependent with this.
Exactly. No, I completely agree. And, you know, the one thing we have to also be cognizant of is that when you inject DMT or you smoke DMT, there's like a cascade effect too. So It's like having an effect on other neurotransmitters as well to modulate your experience. So when you do techniques that are hypothesized to upregulate DMT, it's not just like DMT alone is being upregulated. You're likely upregulating a bunch of other neurotransmitters alongside with it. So, yeah, it's a strange, like, I equate it to, you know, you ever seen those equalizer boards with sound?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like how the brain is, where it's like you got a bunch of neurotransmitters fluctuating, inducing the end result, which is your experience, or on the equalizer board, the sound.
Well, and you're right, too. Like, you know, our neurological system, our body is a profoundly complex system in which everything is finely honed and working interjectually with each other, causing cascades of a variety of different hormones and neurotransmitters. Like, it's, you know, it's unfortunately and fortunately, it's a very difficult thing to explain. And I'm actually really happy that people are seemingly taking this more serious now, as opposed to just being dismissive of it. I think after research says that you have on par dimethyltryptamine with serotonin and dopamine, it makes it very difficult not to inquire why anyone with any sense of curiosity would really have to, you know, think about that. And it seems it's kind of working because you have, you know, groups in Italy doing the same thing.
Yeah. Now it's funny, man. The detractors, like the scientists that are detractors, they won't even acknowledge that, that data point that DMT is at similar levels of serotonin and dopamine. Shout out to you, Dave Nichols. I know you're one of the biggest names out there trying to avoid that. Nichols is funny, man. I mean, I just want to be honest, is that, you know, one of his hypotheses is that it's not DMT having any sort of effect in terms of the near-death experience or things like that. You know, he likes to equate that it's endorphin-dynorphin based on the notion that it binds to the same receptor as salvia. But there's no evidence to indicate that when you inject dynorphin, there's any sort of visionary effect. So I just need to put that out there because sometimes people take a, you know, old school chemist word for it. And it's like, there's no absolutely zero proof that dynorphin induces any visionary effect. Obviously, there's plenty of proof indicating that DMT can induce an effect. So I just wanted to put that out there for the world.
Well, and it's also interesting to note too, is that when you read about DMT experiences, so exogenous, you know, people are talking about being projected into these 580p crystalline worlds with, you know, fractal patterns and interacting with entities. And it's like, that is both different and similar from a lot of NDEs. And one thing I want to point out to a lot of people too, because like when I, you know, when I've been interviewed numerous times about my near-death experience, and I always bring up psychedelics because I think that they dovetail together perfectly. I don't think there's a difference between them. But people always bring that up. Like, did you see machine elves? And I'm like, well, thanks, Tara McKenna, for bringing that visualization to the world. But also, like, a near-death experience is a tailor-made biological release of components within your body. It is not, you know, when I take dimethyltryptamine, much like you stated, I am just having dimethyltryptamine. And yes, other things are working within that. But there's a cascade of effect that occurs in cardiac arrest or these profoundly traumatic experiences. Like, you know, I remember in the hospital afterwards, obviously no one was dialyzing my cerebral spinal fluid. But they were saying like my phosphate was like threefold. Like there was all sorts of weird metabolic shifts in my body that they were like, we really need to pay attention to this. So there's like a whole bunch of things going on, this orchestra, cascade effects of things that were occurring. But at the end of the day, like, you know, people talk about having a near-death experience and interacting with entities, perhaps familiar to them, much like you would experience in a high-dose DMT trip. Like the similarities are there. I think people just have this issue with theology where they bring into it, and it must be God, it must be my family members, and that's what it felt like. But it also deters from the fact, the sense of familiarity that people experience on, you know, high-dose DMT trips. You know, people very frequently saying that this environment that I was in was profoundly familiar. The things I was interacting with had some high degree of familiarity, and perhaps in an absence of all those other cascade chemicals and hormones, that's the byproduct.
Could be, man. Yeah, it's one of the greatest mysteries of life, that's for sure. But it's great to see, I guess you have the DMT researchers that are doing extended state, all the psychedelic research. And then you have guys like Sam Parnia and Bruce Grayson and Jeffrey Long, I think his name, all doing near-death experience research. And I want to do a film. I guess that's kind of one of the things that I'm looking at, is doing a film on death and just taking like the best of the best. So the best of, you know, the people measuring the neuroscience behind it, the best of the best that have actually are in the medical field, the medical doctors that have seen the fact that, you know, people can are reporting things that are in the down the hallway or whatnot. And then there's also a group of scientists that subscribe to things like electromagnetic field theory of consciousness, where there is the chemical aspect, there's electrical aspect, but ultimately it dictates a sort of a field that coincides with our consciousness that they think is like the basis of consciousness, is a sort of like a magnetic field. And it can go from like bottom up, when you take a chemical, it changes the electric oscillations, the magnetic field changes, or it can go from top down, where it's magnetic field stimulation, electrical oscillation changes, and then chemical fluctuations inducing changes in effect. So I just think it would be an interesting storyline to kind of tie in a film around all those things about, you know, how we can go ahead and perceive the near-death experience or even the real death experience. I think it's fascinating.
Well, yeah. And like, you know, and I've talked to a couple of neuroscientists who get into these ideas that consciousness is these quantum tubules, that quantum fluctuations exhibit consciousness, which in a sense almost puts the human brain as a quantum computer in the amount of variability. So it's not binary in the sense of, you know, 0-1. It's multi-pronged, which is sort of a unique concept. But, you know, you were talking before about these doctors who, you know, Bruce Grayson, who I've interviewed on the show, amazing guy, but also Raymond Moody, who is also a doctor who has been categorizing near-death experiences, but he has been categorizing pairs. And I find this really interesting. So do you want to talk a little bit to that? Because that, in a sense, pertains back to your original story about how you had the blood clot and everything else and ideas of telepathy. Because, again, this is endogenous near-death experiences being felt by two people, one of them not dying.
Yeah, Raymond Moody's research is really, it's edge. I would consider it edge research because,
yeah.
I mean, in like double meanings, right? Because you can have, you know, the researchers that'll measure, you know, all the chemicals. And let's say there's like a 2 or 3,000% spike in DMT. So you can have a group of scientists, maybe the majority of neuroscientists, that would be like, okay, we have come to the conclusion as a group that it is a chemical upregulation that's inducing this effect. But that kind of goes a little bit out the window when you bring in Raymond Moody's stuff, where for those of you that don't know about Raymond Moody's research, basically it's, you know, somebody's in a hospital setting, generally speaking, they're getting close to death, their loved ones are around them. And then at the moment of death, the person will pass away, go through the process of flatlining, and then their family members who are in close vicinity to them watching this experience also have an exiting of the body, or the perception that they exited the body, seeing their loved ones exiting their body at the same time. Some of them even go deep enough to see parts of this life review process or whatnot of their loved ones. And yeah, it's amazing stuff. It's like, yeah, shout out to Raymond Moody for having stuck with it for so long, even though I'm sure he's been getting a lot of flack over so many decades. But it's, that's this type of stuff that really pushes our, I guess, our perspective of what is actually out there, what is actually possible, that it's more than just chemical interactions in the brain, that there's probably a chemical component to it, but that there's a little bit more to it as well.
Well, and I've had experiences on psychedelics with people who were dead sober. Like, so this was years ago. It was my birthday and I would want to do a bunch of 5-MeO-DMT and I wanted my dad to be there. And so he comes, this is a crazy story. So he comes over and there's like me, my dad, my friend, and my friend's driving. My dad just sitting there. He's open-minded to damn near anything. My dad is dead sober, doesn't, you know, consume cannabis, doesn't cigarettes. I'm sure he had a coffee that day. Dead sober. And I took a fairly massive amount of 5-MeO-DMT and I just flickered out of consciousness. And and my friend Alex was like, all of a sudden I sat up. I have no recollection of this. I'm like, I love you, Dad. My arm's out. And my dad hugged me. And then we both sort of fell on the mattress together. And all of a sudden, and I have no recollection of this, I'm still lost in this folding, effervescent, beautiful series of fractals. And then I was just interacting with my dad energetically as these two beautiful fractals. And we were like talking about our own insecurities and our fears. And he was communicating about his inability to really project love to me as a child. Like, it was deep. And we like sorted out our father and son shit. You know what I mean? And he was dead sober. Like, maybe he had what I exhaled in a large room diluted to the ambient, you know, ambient air. And, you know, I remember talking to him about that days later. I had to give him a couple minutes. You know, we both came out and he was like hyperventilating. And I'm like, dude, you know, let's breathe. And he was like, I don't know what happened. But he's like, that was one of the most beautiful experiences I could have shared with anyone. And I was happy it was you. And we had a little tears and it was like stunning. And that's not far off that. You know what I mean? Like, it's, and that experiences that Raymond Moody is describing, they're not super isolated. I think people are just terrified about talking to them because you look like a whack job when you're sitting there. And like, there's physicians experiencing it with patients who are dying. There's loved ones experiencing it. But unfortunately, we live in a culture where you say something like that and there's immediate stigma that goes on to you and people start looking at you like you need psychiatric attention.
Yeah, no, it's crazy, man. I mean, people don't realize that Harmine, one of the beta carbolines in the ayahuasca brew, was originally called telepathine because everybody was reporting, not everybody, but enough people were reporting shared type of experiences that it warranted that name. You know, that's the way, I think that was the name that was attributed to it down in like South America. But then they had European researchers that were like, no, that's Harmine. It's not telepathine. another fun fact for people is that, you know, most neuroscience today, you know, they utilize the EEG, right? The EEG device that measures microelectric currents on the scalp that coincide with changes in consciousness. And the founder of that created the EEG to measure telepathy. His name was Hans Berger. So his whole story was like, he fell off a horse one day and then his sister like felt something at a distance and sent a telegram or something crazy like that. This is like in the early 1900s. And then he knew at that point that, you know, there was no way that his sister could have known that he was in danger. And, you know, he knew that telepathy or distant communication was a thing. So, you know, we're still using EEG to this day. And a lot of people don't even know that the origins of it.
That's actually super interesting. Yeah. And so there's something else, too, that is part of your documentary was the work that was done at Louisiana University. And I think that's pretty rad too. And one thing that we should also talk about is not only is dimethyltryptamine endogenous in your brain, but so is 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine, which experientially, I couldn't say that there could be more difference between them. You know, like dimethyltryptamine is to some extent being projected outwards in this 5-ADP multidimensional space. And 5-MeO-DMT is going so deep into yourself that sometimes you come out the other side. But yet, again, both of these are very present in your brain at any given time. And so do you want to talk a little bit about the Louisiana study?
Yeah, sure. So it was an unpublished dissertation from Dr. Stephen Barker's lab mate. And because his lab mate passed away, so he was unable to publish the dissertation. But one of the studies they did was administering LSD to rats. And then they measured, they were looking for just the fluctuations in the brain following the administration of LSD. And they saw that there was a 1,000% increase in endogenous 5-MeO-DMT and a 400% increase in NN-DMT following the LSD administration. This led Dr. Barker to hypothesize that there's an endogenous hallucinatory system that is activated with psychedelics. So psychedelics on their own don't necessarily induce the visionary experience. It's based on the upregulation or the modulation of, you know, neurotransmitters or neurohormones that like DMT, 5-MeO, and maybe some others that we're not even aware of, right? So yeah, very interesting study. We're hoping to go ahead and see if we can, replicate those at, some studies at University of Michigan utilizing, more modern, techniques. Cause obviously that was, I think it took place in the 1980s. Or something like that. So if we can go ahead and replicate that, I'd like to go ahead and actually not just do a replication study of LSD, but also administer MDMA, ketamine, yeah. All those stuff that don't even operate on the serotonergic system that still, though, there might be an effect on the serotonergic system inducing some of those.
Right. Because ketamine's GABA receptor and it still elicits profound, you know, hallucinogenic properties, going deep in yourself, meditative states, outside of disassociation, its use as an analgesic. But yeah, I find that whole thing fascinating because also when you look at saying that there's an endogenous pathway in your brain that an exogenous compound comes in and then causes a cascade release, like why is that there? You know what I mean? Like, again, when we talk it back is that there's, you know, your evolutionary process trims fat everywhere it can. Anything that is not relevant, it generally gets rid of. And yes, there's our vestigial things in the process because evolution takes a long time. You know, my tailbone, you know, appendix to some extent. These things don't serve a purpose, but they're on the way out. And they don't really do anything now in my body. But yet, when you're looking at this, you know, and that's almost a suggest that when you take an exogenous psychedelic, it itself isn't necessarily causing the actual psychedelic experience. It's triggering a cascade response of 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine and dimethyltryptamine, and perhaps providing texture to said experience. So psilocybin, you know, you're having an interesting mix of DMT and 5-MeO-DMT with perhaps some interesting texture that gives the visual differences between all of these psychedelic compounds. Because I think it's safe to say that a psilocybin journey, an ayahuasca journey, and any other of them, they're all uniquely different than the others.
Yeah, definitely an area of research that needs to be sorted out. And I think it's there for to be had. I mean, the scientists are interested. We're just looking to get some of the funding going to execute it. But yeah, it could be really groundbreaking stuff amongst all the other research programs that we're looking at developing.
So out of curiosity then, you know, like in your documentary, and again, just everyone just watch it. You could just turn this off right now and watch it. Like the documentary is fantastic, aside from my, you know, overlapping commentary of it, which is kind of irrelevant. You know, you sort of mentioned, you know, like after the Controlled Bills Act was put in place and you have basically the American government really hijacking down on drugs in general, but psychedelics got put into that. And most likely the anti-war movement, there was dissent within Vietnam. Like, I understand why the government did that. They were worried about losing control. And so now everything's getting opened back up. And you talk about the stages, you know, like the Spirit Molecule when it became a documentary with Joe Rogan narrating it. You know, back in the day, Joe Rogan, not the Joe Rogan you see now, and progressively moving forward. And then Mike Tyson's use of 5-MeO-DMT, which, man, I listened to all of his talks on that. Like, Mike Tyson going from this violent heavyweight champion, you know, spend time in prison, like all of these things, and then having this experience and becoming this profoundly humble spiritual man and talking about it in public. Do you think that this wave is cresting, or do you think that this awareness of dimethyltryptamine is still advancing and there's not really much of a glass ceiling to be seen? Like, I'm just curious because I recognize that sometimes I exist in an echo chamber when it comes to psychedelics. And yes, Michael Pollan spread some awareness. Yes, all of these people are spreading awareness, but are you anticipating in your talking with people, like a massive explosion of research into this, or is this still trickling?
It's coming for sure. No, it's only growing. I mean, well, you can only grow if you're at zero, right? If you start from zero, like, you know, it's exploding from here, but we're having a lot of conversations with people and yeah, no, the interest is growing. I think the public interest is only going to continue growing the more research is published, right? So less speculative stuff, because there's a bunch of like crazy, you know, commentary on DMT on YouTube. There's zillions of them, but high quality research, high quality films. I think that's the key to really increasing the public awareness and also high utility concepts. I mean, we had a conversation regarding DMT and Alzheimer's, right? So can you imagine, you know, there's Dr. Dale Bredesen who's doing great work in terms of the Alzheimer's space using metabolic therapy, lifestyle approaches to reversing early onset mild dementia. Can you imagine if you integrate maybe Wim Hof method altered states, or even somebody would be crazy enough to create like an intranasal DMT for like somebody with dementia, right? And that would have like a positive effect. Can you imagine, you know, the type of media attention could be garnered from that, right? Where people would not just look at DMT as like mystical, spiritual, but high utility concepts of reversing brain issues. So I feel like the sky's the limit. It just depends on the vision, grounding it as much as possible, tying in some mysticism whenever it needs to be, but you have to focus on where's the majority of the public. Is the majority of the public, have they smoked DMT? Have they done ayahuasca? No. So where can we meet them at to create a communicative bridge to create further interest in this?
And I think that was the biggest issue in the 60s was that, you know what I mean? It was all about mystical experience and unity. And you had this, you know, day glow group that was like relatively small, very vocal, very fearful, you know, eliciting this response in the rest of society of being like our society is crumbling and so forth. And now I feel like, you know, yes, there's a big input on mystical experiences, but, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in the psychedelic world and I'm like, you know, the vast majority of people are not ready at this current moment to have a mystical experience. They're not ready to go and do this and let go and face themselves or whatever you want to describe it as. However, I think a lot of people overlook a lot of really positive medicinal value in sub-psychedelic threshold doses. You know, like specifically treatments of neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and dementia, and a variety of other ones too. And even like we were talking about before, the intravenous injection of dimethyltryptamine for people recovering from strokes and showing positive effect. And that can go into acquired head injuries, concussion syndrome. You know, like the list goes on and on with neurodegenerative conditions. And the fact that most treatments that we currently have are not exceptionally good. You know, like the most accepted treatment for dementia now is like what, Aricept, which maybe can delay for a brief period of time with a bunch of other side effects. You know, like I talked about in my very first episode that my father got diagnosed with dementia. I have no sense of time, probably 3.5 years ago. And I started him with a nasal spray of 5-MeO-DMT, which is legal in Canada. You know what I mean? It's not breaking law here. Although microdosing on psilocybin as well. And his cognitive scores after 6 months went from 56 to like 82 or 83. And now they're in the 90s. He should have been dead like a couple years ago. At the very least, he should be in a long-term care facility having his diaper changed. You know what I mean?
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And outside of the fact that they also act as an antidepressant and reduce anxiety, they're also rebuilding his brain. So,
yeah. And the thing is, there is a mechanisms of action. It's not like you're just throwing stuff at it, hoping it works. There's a mechanism of action in terms of neurogenesis, neuroplasticity, anti-inflammatory. It's not like just a random sort of hope that these chemicals can do something. The research is out there to showcase that there is a line, a pathway of logic to administer these things. I think we just need more public awareness, maybe some underground research just to do maybe some films and case studies on people as individuals. And then that can drive enough awareness to drive full on clinical trials. And I think that's the type of stuff that can be developed and will be developed. It just needs a visionary to do so. And I think you're one of them. I might be a part of that, and there's others involved too.
Yeah, no, man, I appreciate that. And, you know, like, it's one of those things that so many people, like, we have a very aging population, and I don't think really people acknowledge what's going on right now when it comes to demographics and how alarming it is that we have these massive, you know, generational groups, specifically, you could call them the boomers, that's generally the name, all going into retirement and into comorbidities. We're going to be seeing, like, man, like 5-6-fold neurodegenerative conditions approaching over the course of the next 15 years. That we have no effective treatments. We lack healthcare systems to deal with it. You know, we're a very reactive society, and our reaction on this is really, really late, if anything. You know what I mean? So it's like, if there was a time for this to happen, it is literally right now. You know, by the time it takes to take a medication, run it through clinical trials and validation and FDA approval and all the shit that's associated with that, that's damn near 10, 15 years in itself. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
No, you're completely right, man. And that's why I think, like, it needs to start from the people, and then it can develop from there. And maybe we'll have the whole world, you know, making their own medications and treating their parents and treating their loved ones. Maybe that's what needs to happen because, yeah, the people can't wait anymore. It's becoming ridiculous how much it's progressed in terms of neurocognitive decline and dementia and things like
that. Well, I hate to be one of those people that, like, well, what if something was different before, because it's irrelevant, because this is the reality that we're currently existing in. But, you know, if they weren't scheduled, you know, if these substances weren't put into the same category as heroin and cocaine, where would we be right now? You know what I mean? Like, it's too bad that prohibition has this tendency to put on blinders on people. And prohibition, along with years of propaganda. Like, man, I remember in high school, you know, there was all of these weird urban myths about psilocybin making your brain bleed and all this other shit. And it turns out to be exactly the opposite. You know what I mean? Like, it just blows my mind. I'm like, oh, if I take this, my brain's going to bleed. Wow, that sounds fucked up. And then you look at all those, you know, anti-drug ads of that brain, and this is your brain on drugs, and they're just clipping away at it with, like, a pair of pliers and wire cutters. And you're like, yeah, you know, literally entire generations of people have been brainwashed. And now undoing that is not something that just happens overnight. It's a long and arduous process to change public perfection, you know, perception after such a long period of misinformation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I completely agree, man. I remember growing up and watching those commercials of somebody frying an egg.
Yeah.
Like, that's your brain on drugs. Yeah. Like, oh boy, I don't even want to eat eggs anymore, man.
I always thought that was weird. I'm like, I love fried eggs, man. I'm like, that never really had a negative effect on me.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a pivotal time for a lot of things, man. I think the public is ready. That's why I also believe that the sub-psychedelic effects of DMT or any psychedelic for that notion, you know, has a high utility concept, because it's maybe not everybody's ready to go deep into like a 5-10 gram, or like you eating a cereal bowl for a psilocybin trip, you know. So maybe the sub psychedelic route is the way to really have the social impact.
And that's my thought on that. I know you can bang the drum about mystical experiences all day long, and at the end of the day, you show the utility that you just described. That is how you get public acceptance. And, you know, like, Uncle Paulin really helped just expose the world via Netflix and in his writings to psychedelics. And now it's almost going to be as much as a grassroots effort as it is relying on all of these larger companies to start pushing forward their research.
Yeah. And it's happening, man. It's just a steady push, especially for the endogenous DMT stuff. You know, we're looking to go ahead and get a lot of projects done at UC San Diego, maybe some partnerships with the University of Michigan and other groups that are motivated enough to go ahead and dive deep into this space.
So awesome conversation, man. So you said you were working on a new film or want to do a new film. So, you know, you're a nonprofit. How do you derive finances to do this?
Bothering a lot of people. So a lot of emails, a lot of discussions, a lot of gray hairs, man. But yeah, that's just the way it comes down to. It's really pitching the vision and seeing if people want to support. Yeah. So if anybody's out there and is interested in supporting research, first and foremost, and then secondary is the films. But I mean, like my main thing is focusing on the research because that's one of the most important parts. And I want to keep it very scientific discourse and educate the public and, you know, just the people who aren't aware of it.
Well, and that's actually one thing I appreciate about your documentary, that it was based on science. There wasn't these wild leaps and wild statements and esoteric shit. It was actually just flat out, this is the research. This is how this is meandering through the scientific community. This is how it's meandering through the public. And this is the results. Like I loved it, man. I've watched it twice.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that was the whole goal, is to try to keep it as grounded as possible. There's enough craziness out there. And don't get me wrong, you know, I'm down with the craziness, but not in terms of presenting science. There's no need to go ahead and integrate that. I think at some point, maybe, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now, once we start to integrate a lot of altered state research in conjunction with endogenous DMT research, you're going to see, you know, some integration, but it's going to be backed by scientific data.
Yeah, and I think that's the way to go. You know what I mean? Like I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And again, I think I've said this like 5 or 6 times, watch the documentary. We'll leave it in a link in the description and also a link to your webpage, just so that people can familiarize themselves with you. If you guys want to get involved with this, let him know. You want to chip some money his way.
Yeah. Just email me. There's links to go ahead and donate. And I want to say I appreciate you and everything you're doing. It's very inspirational in terms of the work you've done with your father, the work you've done with yourself, you know, you sharing your experience out there in terms of your near-death experience and your experiences with DMT and 5-MeO. And, you know, I love connecting with like minds that want to see progress for the world, and you're definitely making an impact. So, yeah, just look forward to watching more of your podcast, and maybe you never know where our visions can go, right?
No, man, I completely agree with that. Thank you for your time, John. You're a rock star.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.